This is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
Direct from the NYU Langone Medical Center, this is Internal Medicine with Dr. Ira Bright.
Hello and welcome to Doctor Radio. This is Dr. Ira Bright and I'm so happy you could be with us today. Do you know that in addition to listening to us, now listening to us is best, there are so many ways to follow us. First of all, give us a call. We have a lot to talk about today. Irritable bowel syndrome, the mind-gut axis, and ready for this, Ebola virus. Could it be coming to us? We will be finding out. You can give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS, which is 1-877-698-3627. But that's not all. We love our social media. Follow us on Facebook. Just go to SiriusXM81, search it out. Find us, follow us, join the conversation. Even better, Twitter. Yep, we loves our Twitter. You can tweet us either at NYU Docs or you can tweet me personally. Say that three times fast. At Dr. Ira. 140 characters of medical goodness. And if it's good, we will put it right on the air. Now, if you have an idea for a show topic, something you want me to talk about, your boss is watching you, they block all that stuff where you're at work, email us. Email us at docs@SiriusXM.com. And of course, as I said, give us a call. Now, as I said, pretty incredible show plan today. We talk about irritable bowel syndrome a lot here, and we talk about functional bowel disease a lot. And a lot of times you get to listen to me, which is pretty good. But in just a few minutes, Douglas Drosman, who's actually one of the world's experts on irritable bowel syndrome and the mind-gut axis, will be joining us, and we're going to be speaking about just that. As a matter of fact, if you are somebody who has suffered with irritable bowel syndrome, haven't quite figured out what to do, stuff isn't working, let's open up the phone lines now. Give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS, which is 1-877-698-3627. After that, we're going to expand the conversation, not just IBS, but anything gastroenterological. It'll be Digestive Disease Update. I will tell you some of the latest and greatest news in the world of digestive disease, as well as answering your questions on any GI topic. Now, Ebola virus and Lassa fever. I didn't even know there was a difference, to be honest with you. You know, this stuff, we always think, oh, it's in Africa. It's going to stay in Africa. I'm just not going to Africa. Okay, it may be able to come here. We're going to be speaking with two of the world's experts on this and find out what's going on with hemorrhagic fever and how it can affect you even if you never want to get on a plane. We're going to end the show, as always, with Ask Dr. Ira, where you can ask me any questions on any medical topic at all. It does not matter what it is. Anything you forgot to ask your doctor, ask me. And as always, our phone number is 1-877-NYU-DOCS, 1-877-698-3627. I'd like to introduce my first guest. Dr. Douglas Drosman is an MD. He's a professor emeritus of medicine and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, where he was on staff from 1977 through 2011. He's the former founder and co-director of the UNC Center for Functional GI and Motility Disorders at the UNC School of Medicine, and now he's in private practice at the Drosman Gastroenterology in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's considered a world authority in the field of functional GI disorders and doctor-patient communication, and his website is Drosman, that's with two S's, gastroenterology, all one word, .com. How are you doing today, Dr. Drosman?
Very fine. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back. We had you on a little bit ago, and I'm very excited to have you back on. And I thought, and we're gonna be talking about irritable bowel syndrome. Now, we spent a lot of time on this show talking about sort of probiotics in irritable bowel syndrome. We'll leave it at that. You know, people with sort of these symptoms, and they talk about probiotics. But there's a lot that has to do with the interactions between the gut and the mind. And I thought we'd really sort of concentrate on that a little bit to start. But even before we do that, I just wanted to go through, when we talk about irritable bowel syndrome, what are we talking about in terms of symptoms? Because everybody seems to know what it is, but nobody can define it.
Sure. Irritable bowel is one of what's called the functional GI disorders. And the first point is, what is a functional GI disorder? And, you know, a lot of times people think about it as the absence of something else. Some people even think it's a psychiatric condition. But it's neither of those. It's a disorder of gastrointestinal functioning. And what that means is patients can have problems with motility, where it can move too fast and too slow. You can have diarrhea or constipation. Sensitivity, meaning that the nerves can fire more than they should and you have more pain, or brain-gut interaction, which means that the brain's ability to modulate or control the gut is impaired. And the symptoms people get for irritable bowel syndrome, which is the most common, is abdominal pain or discomfort, often associated with change in bowel habit like diarrhea or constipation. And then you can get other symptoms like bloating, nausea, and the like.
Right. One of the things that people always ask me and when they come to the office, and they'll go, is like, so how do you know I don't have cancer? Or how do you know I don't have celiac disease? Or pick another disease that's not irritable bowel syndrome. Sort of how far do you go in terms of evaluating somebody for this sort of stuff?
Well, that's a really important question. First of all, remember, the functional GI disorders are the absence of structural diagnoses like celiac disease or cancer or things like that. But that runs the risk of people overdoing the tests. First of all, the GI conditions like irritable bowel are so common, it's up to about 10% of the population, that by sheer numbers, something like Crohn's disease is 100th to 1,000th that number. But the way you can identify it is that there are specific criteria that have been set up. This is called the Rome criteria, which defines you having these symptoms for a period of time, and then you have abdominal pain that's usually relieved by a bowel movement and associated with diarrhea or constipation or both. Then what the doctor does is he looks for what's called red flags. Red flags are symptoms like blood in the stool, weight loss, abnormal physical exam, or abnormal blood tests. If any of those show up, then he or she pursues diagnostic studies. Most patients should have a colonoscopy, but a lot of other studies like CT scan, things like that, are not needed unless there are these red flags or markers. And it also depends on age. If you're 20 years old and having IBS from an exam in college, the doctor may not do any studies at all. You have the diagnosis just by the criteria.
I would say if you're 20 years old and not having IBS with an exam, there's probably you should be evaluated for something. So that's the case with that. So we know this. It's sort of a nebulous diagnosis. And I guess, you know, we talk about this sort of what everybody asked me this. Matter of fact, I got an email from a patient literally 5 minutes before we got on air, and I had explained to her that she had irritable bowel syndrome and what we were going to sort of do about it to start and see what's going on. And she emailed me back, why do I have this? What is going on? So I guess that's the big question that we ask. You know, it's very easy for us to say sort of, oh, you know, it's fine. It's not Crohn's disease. It's not cancer. You don't have celiac disease. You just have this thing. But then everybody sort of asks you, well, when you have irritable bowel syndrome, even if you say, oh, you have hypermotility or hyper, you know, I'm going to use the word hyperviscosity only because I watched too much NASCAR over the weekend kind of thing. But, like, you know, you have all these hyper this and hyper that. Everybody wants to know why. So what's going on in there?
Well, again, it's the change in the functioning of the GI tract. And I think, first of all, there can be genetic predispositions. People can have this in families. Another thing that's becoming very interesting now, which you've alluded to with probiotics, is the microflora, or the composition of the bacteria seems to be different. And sometimes in a simplest way, we break it down to good bacteria and bad bacteria. And people with irritable bowel syndrome seem to have more of the bad bacteria and less of the good bacteria. And probiotics is one example of how people are looking to treat that, just like antibiotics are sometimes used. So it turns out that the bad bacteria can affect the lining of the gut, make it more permeable, what people call leaky gut, and that can lead bacteria to send out products that go into the gut, and that can sensitize the nerves, and those nerves, as a result, can become, when you eat or the bowel stretches and you can feel it more. So that's one reason why you can have it. And there's a study that came out just this week showing that people with irritable bowel have a higher incidence of having salmonella gastroenteritis, or the other way around, people with in childhood who had salmonella gastroenteritis were more likely to have irritable bowel as an adult.
We actually talked about it on the air last week. I plucked that out. I was very excited that I had found it. Yeah, no, it was like in Italy, they had followed all these like kids with irritable who had salmonella, and they found that they had a higher percentage of IBS as adults than their colleagues who did, your kids, fellow kids who did not get it. So there really is something going on with the bacteria as things go.
That's the gut part.
I want to get to the mind part, but first I have to do the reintroduction. So this is Dr. Ira Bright, and you are listening to Dr. Radio here on Sirius XM 81, and I am joined by Dr. Douglas Drossman, who is Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina and in private practice at Drossman Gastroenterology, also in North Carolina. He is an expert on the irritable bowel syndrome, and we are talking about IBS. If you are somebody who has had IBS and you have been wondering what to do, things don't seem to be working, maybe the doctor gave you fiber and you're like, it's just making it worse, give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS, which is 1-877-698-3627. So let's go to the mind here, because this is like the new fascinating thing, because I vaguely, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I vaguely remember learning in medical school way back in the 80s when we all had shoulder pads and wore like bright pastel colors. And our collars were up. I remember learning that there was, you know, there was a nervous system of the intestine. We all seem to know that. And it seemed to react a little bit with your head. But everybody sort of poo-pooed the thing. They said, like, yeah, gut brain, human brain, don't worry about it. That was, like, I think, the extent of it. But there's more going on now, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting research going on. But, you know, the background is, first of all, the gut, the nervous system of the gut is what we call hardwired to the spinal cord and brain. You know, the embryo is has one neural plate, and as the embryo develops, it differentiates into the brain and the spinal cord, and then it sends out nerve tracts that go into the gut. So there's a very direct connection. In fact, no organ is as closely connected to the brain. And healthy individuals are aware of it. You know, they can get constipation when they travel. They can get diarrhea when they have an exam. They use terms like, I can't stomach that, you make me want to vomit. These are very common ways people think about these things because it's so closely connected. So when you talk about irritable bowel syndrome, you have the activation from the gut, which is where the nerves overfire and the motility and the immune alteration. But then the brain has a role in modulating it. We don't have, when pain signals go to the brain, it's not just what comes from the gut, but it's the combination of the pain signals going from the gut to the brain and the brain turning it down or turning it up. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
If you're running a race and you're at the finish, getting close to the finish line, and you sprain your ankle, you may not feel that pain, because you're so focused on getting to the finish line that the brain turns down those signals. The injury is there, but you don't feel it. After the race, you collapse to the ground, you can't get up because it hurts so much. That's an example of how the brain can control signals coming from the gut. Hypnosis can do it as well. You can be made to have pain, or you can make pain go away. The opposite is also true, and this is where the stress comes in. If you have a stressful day, or a stressful life experience, it can impair the brain's ability to turn down those signals, and it can lead to more signals coming up, and you have more pain. So the brain-gut connection is the combination of how the brain is functioning relative to the pain or the signals coming from the gut.
So is there any typical, if somebody has irritable bowel syndrome, somebody's been told, they've gone to the doctor, and they've sort of been told, oh, you have IBS, and you're fine, and let's make the assumption that, you know, they've had a colonoscopy and this and that, and they truly have IBS. Is there anything that we as sort of clinicians can do to pinpoint what's going on and say, oh, when you were 14 years old, you know, you started having a lot of stress because of the braces. I'm making something up here. And because of that, you know, it started affecting your intestines. And if we work on that, your intestinal stuff will go away.
Sure. There are two parts of the way the stress can be affecting it. One is, like you're mentioning, you know, you could have had early stress or current stress, and that could be affecting the brain's ability to control the pain. And this is very separate from whether you have a psychiatric problem. You could be stressed. But the other thing that happens is that when people develop a chronic disease, their whole sense of themselves changes. They get more stressed. The condition, and this is more, a lot more acceptable to patients to understand that having chronic pain can lead to changes in how you see the world. Will I be able to go back to work? Will I keep my job? Will I be able to go out and socialize or go on a date? That kind of stress feeds back, and we call it a vicious cycle.
So that feeling, just to, sorry to interrupt, but just that feeling, let's say that I have people who will walk in and go, Ira, you know, I'm worried about getting on the subway to work because I'm worried that I know that there is no bathroom between here and wherever I go to work type of thing. That feeling can literally play back on itself?
Absolutely, and it affects the person because they start to say, why can't I control this? What did I do wrong? I've always controlled things in my life, and I feel like a failure with this. Those, we call them negative cognitions. Sometimes people call it catastrophizing. And those kinds of feelings have been shown through brain imaging to impair the brain's ability to control the pain. And you said, what can be done about it? Well, there are methods. There are methods like psychologic treatments. And again, this is not talking about your childhood, but talking about how you deal with day-to-day existence, how going out could make you feel fearful and set your symptoms going. That's called cognitive behavioral therapy.
But it's not because, and I think this is important, these feelings, it's not like I'm depressed and my stomach hurts. It's more like my stomach hurts and therefore I get depressed. It's almost like if you have to do sort of chicken egg, it's the stomach pain is the leading, or the IBS is the leading problem and not some kind of psychiatric something or other.
Right. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that if 10% of the population have IBS, 10% don't have psychiatric problems. Most of them don't. But it's the distress that leads to it. That doesn't mean that those who have anxiety, depression, are also going to have more severe IBS. That's certainly the case, too. But the treatments could be the same. And the treatments are rethinking the threat of this, getting more control over your life. This can be done through active programs like CBT, meditation. It can be done through hypnosis.
Does the hypnosis really? I have to ask you this because, like, I have people who come to me, you know, who say, oh, I went to the hypnosis guy here in New York. There's, like, one hypnosis guy who's near my office. And, like, he made me stop smoking, or he made me do this or that or the other thing. Does it work with irritable bowel syndrome? If you're somebody who's getting bloated and, like, having to run to the bathroom, hypnosis actually works?
Well, there are two big programs that have done a lot of the research. One is in Manchester, England, by Peter Warwell, and he showed this back 20 years ago. And then Ole Paulsen at UNC has done the same thing. And it's associated not only with changes in the symptoms you feel, but there are brain imaging changes to show that that area of the brain is working better. So, yeah, hypnosis is one option. Of course, any of these treatments are not for everybody. You have to be motivated to do it. The other thing we can talk about are the antidepressants.
I want to get to that, but again, first, the reintroductions. This is Dr. Ira Bright, and you are listening to Dr. Radio here on Sirius XM 81, and I'm joined by Dr. Douglas Drossman, who is a professor of medicine and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina, where he was on staff through 2011, and now he's in private practice at Drossman Gastroenterology. He is a world expert on the irritable bowel syndrome, IBS. If you are somebody who has IBS and you've been wondering what to do, perfect person to ask. Give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS, which is 1-877-698-3627. And actually, let's take a call. Let's go to Olga. Olga in West Virginia. Hey, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Not a problem. What's going on?
I'm just curious, how does IBS affect children? For example, my 10-year-old, she constantly has issues with her belly, and to the point that we actually took her to emergency room, and we think that maybe it's a constipation or something else, but she's really in pain most of the time. Is this something that maybe she has, and what can I do to help her?
That's an excellent question. So, Doug, let me ask you this. I think, at least in my mind, as we've been talking, I've been envisioning a 24-year-old woman, as we've been saying this, because because that's what I see all day. But a lot of kids have stomach aches and this and that and the other thing. Is their stomach achy stuff, is that similar to the irritable bowel syndrome that adults have?
It's similar. As children, it's often been called recurrent abdominal pain in children, and it's a can be a big cause of school absenteeism. And first of all, there can be a slight genetic component if the family has it. But the other component in children is behavioral. Let me give you an example. If Johnny is about to go to school for the first time and he has a stress response and a normal stomach pains and sweaty and anxious, and the parent says, Johnny, you've got a stomach ache, why don't you stay home from school and you can watch TV, and when you're better, you go back to school. That can be conditioned where the child, when he or she feels anxious, may not be able to go to school again, and we see from our research that those are the people who go to the doctor more. Now, if the parent says, Johnny, you get a tummy ache, you must be nervous about going to school, let's talk about it, that child tends to go to the doctor less as an adult. So some of it is genetic, it could be an early infection, but the behavior of how a child relates to it, whether they see it as scary or whether they need to go to the doctor or whether the parent takes them, can be conditioned. And there's even research to show that when parents change the way they respond to it, the child doesn't have as many symptoms.
That's very interesting. So Olga, just in terms of your own child, she's been going to the, how many times has she gone to the emergency room?
I think last year we took her like twice. This year we didn't take her yet. And I guess the response from doctors were always like, you know, it's common in children and she probably has constipation, she needs to drink water. So you're thinking that that's probably what she has. It's nothing serious that I have to worry about.
Well, if she has constipation, that should be treated, right? I don't know if water is the best solution, but there are other ways to treat it. But okay. I think it's also when they have the pain and they get a little scared and they don't want to move on to school, that's where I think you have to think about trying to understand what's making it worse now.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for your call, Olga. If you have any questions for me or for Douglas Drossman, who's an expert in irritable bowel syndrome, give us a call at 1-877-NYU-DOCS, which is 1-877-698-3627. It's funny, Doug, you know, you were talking about the sort of go-to-school thing. I tell you a story the opposite. Of course, I am a doctor. My wife is a doctor, and I think you've met my wife at some point in time. And so, of course, our children get the opposite treatment. And true story, one of my kids had the swine flu, or the beginnings of the swine flu. Remember the swine flu going around a couple of years ago?
Sure.
And we're like, and he was like, I don't feel that good. We're like, you're fine. You're going to school. Literally threw him on the bus, and we got like an angry call from the nurse at the school. Your child has 103 fever. How could you have sent him? Oops. So I think it's true with these things. You have to be careful both ways because, you know, every now and then a kid has an appendix.
Yep.
So as things go. So what's the story with antidepressants and irritable bowel syndrome? Because everybody, you know, it's like, I think there are two issues here. One is, you know, if somebody said you have irritable bowel syndrome and then I'm like, well, maybe you should take an antidepressant. I will tell you that whoever I'm speaking to goes, you really think I'm crazy? I'm not crazy. Number one. And number two is, why would they work in the first place if you're not crazy or depressed?
Yeah. Well, see, that's really the, as a gastroenterologist, you know, even primary care doctors are dealing with it. Just the mention of an antidepressant leads to that reaction. And that has to do with our, you know, what we call mind-body dualism, that if there's nothing there, if you can't find anything, then it must be psychiatric. And that goes back to Descartes, and that's a whole other story. But what we're really talking about is antidepressants act in the gut. They can reduce signaling from the gut, and they can also improve the brain's ability to turn down the pain. And that is, the data shows, independent of whether you have depression or not. Now, if you have depression, it can help that too, often in higher doses. In fact, one of the things I try to tell patients is you're using medication in dosages lower than you're using for treating major depression. It's acting at a lower dose on pain control pathways.
But it's used for pain. Do have these sort of like people when they use antidepressants for irritable bowel syndrome, does it work for like diarrhea or constipation or anything like that, or just for the pain part?
No, it's for both. And that's where you have to select what you're going to use. The tricyclic antidepressants, which are hardly used in psychiatry anymore, are commonly used in medicine. And those have what we call anticholinergic properties. What it means is it can slow down diarrhea. And so if you have diarrhea-predominant IBS, you might use a tricyclic for the pain and for the diarrhea.
And these are real old-school antidepressants, something like Elavil or something like that.
That's right. And they're also what are called dirty drugs because they have side effects like the anticholinergic. So sometimes patients don't tolerate higher doses because they get like an antihistamine effect. They dry mouth and blurry vision and dizzy, and so sometimes it's hard to push it. So we use low doses. Then there are newer classes of drugs, which we call SNRIs, and those agents, duloxetine is an example, that don't have those side effects. They have a little bit different side effect, a little bit of nausea, but not as common as the others. And we often use that if we can't get the tricyclic to go to a higher level. If they have diarrhea, we might use something like an SSRI. Like Prozac.
Prozac, like regular plain old stuff that, you know, every primary care doctor and every psychiatrist in America gives all the time.
Right. And that can help with anxiety as well. But I think it's very important to keep in mind that you're using these drugs for treating IBS not because of a psychiatric problem. If you're using it for a psychiatric problem, you may need higher doses.
Got it. It's really, and do you find, and I'm actually curious if anybody's been this way. You can give me a tweet if you just want a little quick thing at Dr. Ira here at NYU Docs. If anybody's doctors recommended ever going on an antidepressant at all for not because you're depressed, if you just thought that was the weirdest thing in the world, just let us know because I am actually curious about it. Because every time I say it to somebody, Doug, it's just like they give you that look.
Yeah.
Like, you think I'm crazy. I'm like, really, I don't. It's just, I'm sorry. It's a thing of drug. Let's take another call. Let's go to David. David, actually, in North Carolina. Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
So, I have a question about Linzess. But before I go into that, just on based on your last comment, my wife, who has some acid reflux issues, her doctor back in New York had prescribed that she takes Zoloft in a very, very small amount, the smallest possible that she can take. And it's been very effective. But the problem is, you know, whenever she shows that she's taking that on any health insurance questionnaire, they're immediately saying that she's got a psychiatric disorder. And she says, no, that's not true. And, you know, we go back to the doctor in New York to validate the fact that she's taking it for her gastrointestinal problem. But, you know, it is an ongoing problem that whenever you take one of these drugs, they think that it's for depression or anxiety.
That I would agree with that statement completely, David.
Doug, I don't know if
you see that, but it becomes a big deal. Like somebody applies for a job or this or that. I mean, I'm no lawyer and I don't know any of that stuff, but it's definitely
right.
Freaks people out.
You have to get approval all the time. You have to fill out these forms. It's ridiculous.
So anyway, I've suffered with chronic constipation for many, many years, and I've taken fiber and over the counter products like Dulcolax, and recently I've been taking Linzess. I'm sure you've heard of that drug, haven't you, Dr. Dressman?
Yes.
So sometimes I have very good reactions to it, and I'm taking the larger quantity. Sometimes I have an effective bowel movement, but sometimes it's diarrhea, and I'm just totally just liquid. And I'm wondering if that's a common reaction to this drug and if there's any advice you can give me on how to avoid that and whether or not you think that maybe I would be a candidate to take a low dose of one of these antidepressant drugs, like, my wife takes Zoloft, or I know that Lexapro is a very popular drug these days, whether or not that may have an effect on calming down whatever's going on with me, gastroenterology?
So we have somewhat limited time here. By the way, if you're waiting, we're going to get to you in gastroenterology update in the next segment. So, Doug, what I really want to actually ask about here is this drug Linzess, because, you know, we've been talking a lot about sort of non-GI drugs, for lack of a better word, for irritable bowel syndrome. But Linzess is, like I can tell you, because the salesman pound me all day, is a drug for chronic constipation. How does that work?
Sure. And I think that this is acting at the gut level. And there really are two drugs that are active, what are called chloride channel activators, and Linzess is one, and Amitiza is another. And they act by increasing chloride secretion into the gut, which pulls in water. So it acts as actually increasing the amount of water that goes into the stool from the small bowel, and some from the colon. Linzess also can help pain because it seems to activate a chemical called cyclic GMP, which might turn down the nerves a little bit. The other thing I should mention is that if you're having a lot of diarrhea, there are two things to think about. One is that the dosage of the drug may be too strong, because diarrhea is an obvious side effect. And the other is there are some people who are so constipated that they have like a plug of stool in their colon, and they take the drug, and the fluid comes through and goes around the stool, and you have diarrhea. And if you took an X-ray or even feel your belly, you can feel that plug of stool. So when people get a lot of diarrhea and they still feel constipated, you need to take a flush, a colonic flush like for a colonoscopy, to empty your colon out, and that might reset your bowels.
So that's a good idea. I'm going to hold on, just because we're running very short on time, David, on the question of the SSRI, but I will say that it's one of those things that's probably worth discussing with your physician, because there is some good evidence that it helps. So I'm going to answer for everybody for that one. I'd like to thank Dr. Douglas Drossman, who's a professor emeritus of medicine and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, where he was on staff from 1977 through 2011, former founder and co-director of the UNC Center for Functional GI and Motility Disorders at the UNC School of Medicine, now in private practice at Drossman Gastroenterology, and you can check it out at drossmangastroenterology.com. All one word. Doug, thank you so much for coming on today. Incredibly informative.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this is Dr. Ira Bright, and you are listening to Dr. Radio here on Sirius XM 81. When we come back, it'll be time for Gastroenterology Update, where I will tell you some of the latest and greatest news in gastroenterology, not just IBS. You name it. The liver, the pancreas, the gallbladder, even heartburn. 1-877-NYU-DOCS. We'll keep the phone lines open over the break, and we'll be right back.
This is Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 81, and on the Sirius XM app for smartphones.